From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting this week from Atlanta, Georgia. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sunday is the Buddhist observance of Visakha Puja, as well as the Christian feast of Pentecost. And next Saturday, Muslims mark Laylat al-Bara'ah. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, in a powerful rebuke to North Carolina's anti-LGBT law, Attorney General Loretta Lynch spoke out boldly for inclusivity and equality under the law. Her words came even as the Justice Department filed suit against North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory, who promptly branded the action bullying. Well, of course he did. Donald Trump saw the beautiful wall between his candidacy and far-right Christians fall a bit this week when the notorious David Lane, leader of the American Renewal Organization, mass-mailed 100,000 pastors urging their support for the presumptive Republican nominee. Of course, other prominent conservative faith leaders like Jerry Falwell Jr. have been on the Trump train for months, and Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson has now aimed his support at the billionaire candidate as well. Representative Don Beyer of Virginia introduced a bill aimed at preventing the kind of wholesale discrimination against Muslims and others that's been a shocking part of this year's presidential campaign. The Freedom of Religion Act of 2016 would ban faith-based discrimination at the border. A broad coalition of organizations led by Interfaith Alliance has rallied in support of the measure. Meanwhile, Interfaith Alliance of Colorado launched an ambitious faith spokespeople program, offering expert voices to counterbalance the all-too-often exclusionary, divisive messages Americans hear in the name of faith. And congratulations to Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, which celebrated 20 years of important work last weekend. Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline was on hand to help mark the occasion. That is a good, great group of people in Iowa. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
You know who loves me? The evangelicals. You know, I'm leading with evangelicals. I love them. They love me.
I love the Bible. I love the Bible. I went to Sunday school.
Get out the evangelical vote, and then those issues are dropped.
A dominant theme of several presidential elections now has been the disproportionate impact of the evangelical Christian vote, particularly during the primary season. Well, that theory doesn't seem to have held this time around. We'll discuss the possible reasons when I am joined once again by investigative journalist and author Sarah Posner.
Inerrancy functions as a way of, I think, obscuring a deeper interaction with the biblical text and what it's doing.
The sin of certainty. Why God desires our trust more than our correct beliefs. Now, that's quite a title, isn't it? But a growing number of leading writers have been exploring this general idea that doubt is an essential part of an authentic journey of faith. On this week's show, you'll meet the author of The Sin of Certainty, Professor Peter Enns. But first,
now, more than 100 pastors, deacons, elders, and candidates for ministry in the United Methodist Church released a letter publicly coming out as LGBT just one day before the church's top policymaking body convenes in Portland.
The United Methodist Church is the largest mainland Protestant denomination in the United States. As organized religion has moved to varying degrees on the issue of homosexuality, the UMC has been the target of growing dissent and defiance among members and clergy alike. On this show, we've had the privilege of hearing from heroes of this movement like the Reverend Robin Heneke of Philadelphia, as well as national names like Reverend Frank Schaefer and early on the Reverend Jimmy Creech. Right now, the denomination's general conference is underway, and the issue of LGBT inclusion is a hot topic indeed. At the forefront of the call for inclusivity within the church is the Reconciling Ministries Network, and I am very pleased to be joined by Matt Berryman, who heads that organization. Matt, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be on the show with you.
Is there a shorthand summary of the state of things for LGBT United Methodist Church members and clergy that we could use just to begin the conversation?
For many years now, in increasingly serious ways, the LGBTQ population within the United Methodist Church has been disenfranchised from various forms of membership and also participation in the ranks of clergy and the level of bishops. There's been chargeable offenses related to clergy who perform same-sex weddings, and then also the potential decredentialing, or as some like to call it, defrocking of United Methodist clergy who come out as self-avowed and practicing homosexuals, to use the language of the Book of Discipline. So for a very long time now, with increasing severity, the church has made it clear that it does not condone nor wish to welcome LGBTQ people within the life of the United Methodist Church on a kind of policy level. So at this particular moment, we are poised at the General Conference in Portland to legislate once again whether or not the United Methodist Church will continue with codified discrimination against a whole class of persons.
Matt, talk about this coming out letter that was signed by more than 100 clergy members just ahead of the General Conference.
The Reconciling Ministries Network inaugurated a number of months ago a national advocacy campaign to focus on General Conference called It's Time. And we've had several high-profile same-sex weddings, and many of our folks within our movement have participated in some very profound ways. And one of those was a clergy coming out letter, an open letter sent by 100-plus queer clergy and candidates from around the country in one mass effort to disrupt the system by essentially declaring that they are in direct conflict with the United Methodist policy, and that it, by virtue of the sheer numbers and the ally support that's being leveraged, is essentially becoming unenforceable.
What kind of immediate responses have you seen coming to you from that letter?
Given the very public nature of this campaign and the ways in which the anxiety has been ramped up by our active pursuit of the gospel for LGBTQ people, the responses have been ranging from the far right that is just simply angry and wants to leave the church to the more institutionalist, even we would say moderate voices, to progressive voices who are committed to the institution, who are just flustered and anxious and exhausted by it, and on some level a little bit angry with our activism because it makes life uncomfortable for everybody.
Sure.
And our activism around it is obviously working to the extent that it's got people actively seeking ways to figure this whole thing out. But it doesn't make for happy people all the time.
Sure.
So,
Reconciling Ministries Network, would you explain what that network is? I think our listeners would love to hear what the Reconciling Ministries Network's all about.
The organization began around 30 years ago, committed to the full inclusion of LGBTQ people at every level of the church's life, and continues with that primary mission, although we've expanded and grown to a real powerful place, both within the denomination, but also within the broader movement for LGBTQ justice that is civil in nature, so that we have a role to play in faith-based messaging from a LGBTQ perspective around what it means to end discrimination more broadly construed. The network contains communities and churches and individuals across the nation who affiliate as a reconciling church or a reconciling individual, which means that they take an active political stance in the life of the church, voicing their own institutional or personal commitment to the gospel as they understand it for the marginalized and the oppressed, which isn't now simply about LGBTQ people, but also is at the intersections of anti-racism and many other of the isms, gender inequality, sexism, mm-hmm. et cetera, that are intertwined and sort of bundled with LGBTQ oppression.
You and your team are on the ground in Portland where the General Conference is taking place. How much access does the Reconciling Ministries Network have in that setting?
We have a lot of access. The organization and the movement itself that it represents is well respected and a large force within the conversation, and has a place at the table in terms of how this moves forward. The conference is very definitely owned in some ways by this conversation, and we've managed to create a kind of a narrative that everyone is aware of and that is leveraging all of the power that we have mm-hmm. here and abroad, you know, out in the culture to create change. So I think we have quite a lot of access, but we work within a system, and the system is breaking down, but mm-hmm. we haven't seen it yet ready to fold completely, bending toward the arc of justice. We're seeing a lot of incremental and in some ways fast change, but we have not quite reached a tipping point yet, and that mm-hmm. tipping point may be here this next 2 weeks, but it's hard to tell at this point.
Matt, we are taping this conversation on Thursday. I've read in some media earlier today a kind of characterization of the situation as one in which you're being told you are a sacred group of people, but you're just not welcome in all of the areas of ministry in the United Methodist Church.
Absolutely right. Totally. Many people would like to have their cake and eat it too in that regard, but you can't have it both ways. You can't say you're welcome here, but you're not welcome here, because this is the function of guilt, liberal guilt. We will not grant you the fullness of your own sort of humanity in a sort of equal or just sense, but we want to be able to claim that we do see you as equal. And this is, of course, part and parcel of how moderates and progressives make themselves feel good at night when they go to sleep. They say, well, I really believe in full inclusion, but, you know, the church is what it is right now and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Many people in the church want to say, oh, we really like you, but, and we're just continuing to remind people that that's not true.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Be very specific, Matt, in saying what changes you're calling for in the church.
We are asking for a removal of any discriminatory language that seems to indicate that either in policy or practice, LGBTQ people will not be considered equal in both the sight of God and in the eyes of the church and in the ways that we practice ministry in the United Methodist Church. To be a little bit more specific, we would ask that clergy who perform same-sex weddings no longer face punishment. We would ask that LGBTQ people are eligible, as long as they are qualified, to become ministers in the same sense that straight, cisgender people are allowed. We would ask that any negative language in the Book of Discipline that seems to indicate marginal value of LGBTQ people would be not only expunged, but would be replaced with language that actually reflects the way Jesus beholds LGBTQ people mm-hmm. in his own heart. So we're asking that the right thing be done and that the gospel would be fulfilled at this general conference.
Mm-hmm. Matt, when you headed for the conference this year, was it the same feeling that you've had in the past? How likely is meaningful progress this time around?
The context for this general conference is vastly different from the one in 2012. But also, you know, the drumbeat for inclusion in the United Methodist Church has taken on a feverish pitch. And many, many, many public matters have come to the fore, including Frank Schaefer and many others, Reverend Cynthia Meyer, who came out in Kansas in the early part of this year, which created a national conversation around that. We've arrived at the conversation here at General Conference in a very different place, because there is a general sense that the church cannot go on like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not that means that traditional legislative change will occur in the ways that people commonly expect it to is unclear.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there's reason to hope that there are many, many more people working to figure out a way through this for the sake of the denomination this time around that were not on board last time around. You know, I don't know. It's sort of a daily thing what to expect
sure.
each day and how everything seems to be moving, but I feel like we're in a very, very different place. It would not surprise me if we see some kind of change. I'm not sure how it will happen yet, and I certainly don't feel like it's a guarantee.
Sure.
But I also don't feel like we're in at all the same place that we were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. The ball is down the field quite a far way.
Matt Berryman is Executive Director of the Reconciling Ministries Network. From 2002 through 2009, Matt served United Methodist congregations in the Jacksonville area of the Florida Conference. Since 1984, the Reconciling Ministries Network has been mobilizing United Methodists of all sexual orientations and gender identities to transform our church and world into the full expression of Christ's inclusive love. Matt, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so very much. I really appreciate your time and your willingness to shine a light on the cause.
In a recent interview, one of our favorite guests on State of Belief, the prolific Bishop John Shelby Spong, emphasized how he sees a mature faith as not just allowing for, but essentially requiring doubt. The sacredness of uncertainty has come up again since then, and now a book-length exploration of the subject has appeared titled The Sin of Certainty, Why God Desires Our Trust More Than Our Correct Beliefs. And I am very pleased that the author of that book is with us on the show today, Dr. Peter Enns. Pete, welcome.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
How did this latest book come about?
Good question. I think I've been writing it for a very long time. I'm in my mid-50s now, but I recall asking questions like this and doing some journal writing when I was in my 20s. But you know, maybe more specifically, it's life experiences, whether it's family or professional, that have brought me to see that what I know or what I think I know is valuable, but it's probably not the end of the story. I'm just a person, and I'm not always certain. Life events happen that cause you to doubt things that you thought you were certain about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the book really is about that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not broken. There's nothing wrong with you. That's a natural part of faith. And, in fact, those parts perform a very necessary function, in my opinion, which is to drive you further towards a deeper faith, a more well-rounded faith that rests not on our ability to understand or comprehend, but rests on our willingness to be subject to God and to submit and to trust God.
Mm-hmm. You use a very strong phrase, which I appreciate, but must ask you about. Why do you call certainty a sin as opposed to perhaps an error or a sign of immaturity?
Because it's a good punch. It's a good title. But actually, there is a reason why I call it. You see, sin, I mean more of like of a falling short, mm-hmm. a dysfunction, an incompleteness, not I'm making God angry kind mm-hmm. of thing. You know, I'm not using the term really in that sense. But certainty is not a sin,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we feel certain, and for different reasons, we feel certain at various stages in our lives, right? Mm-hmm. And there are times when, you know, people are just more comfortable with the state of their faith than at other times. And those times when we feel comfortable, those are not sinful times. Like, you have to be doubting. What's wrong with you?
Mm-hmm.
The sin of certainty is feeling the need to hold on to that familiar certainty at all costs.
Because
mm-hmm. you're actually selling God short, I think, and you're selling your own life and your own process short by wanting to stay put. And use the word maturity. I think that's a very good word to use in that context because it's somewhat analogous to a child who just mm-hmm. doesn't want to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to stay home with mom and dad. No, you have to go. Yeah, but my life's falling apart. You don't know what's happening to me. This is so hard. Yeah, but in time, you actually see the benefit of that process of feeling uncomfortable and your world becomes bigger. It's opened up and it's a more pleasing and pleasant life to live.
Mm-hmm. What's the damage caused by the kind of certainty you describe?
Well, it probably varies from people to people, but I think one thing is it can make your journey of faith one of perhaps anger because of fear. You're living a life of fear, and so you become angry with other people. You can become very difficult to live with. You model a faith that's always somewhat defensive and protective rather than offensive in a good sense of the word and proactive. And I think that diminishes our full humanity, which I think is one thing that the life of faith is supposed to be helping us with, right? To become fully human as Jesus was fully human, right? And to really become a full person and a healthy person because of communion with God. Abdicating that responsibility to journey is something that I think really I don't want to live that way.
You know,
I just can't. I can't imagine really going through life always being afraid and protecting what you think and hating people who think differently. It can make you a difficult person to live with, a difficult person to work with, a person who is not modeling a vibrant, positive faith in, to the world around them. It's detrimental on various levels.
Do you think our culture feeds into this need for absolutism?
I think we are living at a time, as many people have said, of sort of, let's call it a fundamentalist backlash to the increased uncertainty and unsettlement in our lives and in the world around us. And I think what we're seeing, you know, in religious faith is this circling the wagons and drawing the reins in and really pushing the idea of certainty. And I think it could be part of our modern lives and just the world that we live in, that we're seeking a certain kind of security amid tumultuous times. And if there's any place you should have certainty, it's in your religious life.
Yeah.
And I think that's how it's often conceived.
What does this say about fundamentalism then, whether found in any given religion or, for that matter, among the non-religious, because they're certainly atheist fundamentalists as well?
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way, and I don't want to be misunderstood, but I think, in that sense, fundamentalism is an immaturity. It's an immature version of something that is driven by the fear of what's out there and the need to maintain a certain rigid way of thinking about yourself and the world around you, promoting us versus them thinking, these are bad people, we need to kill them or ostracize them and keep away from them so we remain pure. Yeah, I think those are sort of implications of this kind of thinking.
I spend a lot of my life at the intersection of religion, government, and politics, and I've been persuaded for quite some time that when the whole idea of religious certainty got transferred over to political certainty, that we saw a real hit to democracy.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe putting it that way, I would say that the need to maintain a system of certainty, it may not simply be religious, it's also political. I would say the overarching word is that it's ideological.
Right.
And when you have ideologies, that's certainly a political phenomenon. It can be a religious phenomenon. It doesn't have to be. You know, whether, you know, we can pick on ISIS, for example, as an ideology, and certainly certain brands of other faiths as well, including very much including Christianity. We have a long history of ideologically motivated pogroms and things like that. So ideologies don't work well with ambiguities. They work well with, here's the way it is. Here's what the world looks like. Here are the good people. Here are the bad people. And you do something about the bad people.
And isn't it also true that if you come at life with that commitment to certainty, there's very little room for dialogue between people who differ from each other?
Well, in fact, not only is there no room, but you're in principle committed not to do that.
Yeah.
There is no dialogue.
Yeah.
There is no community collective thinking. There are just, it's fascism, right?
Yeah. I mean,
there's just, it's rules handed down. This is how you do it. Which is why, you know, one reason I spend a lot of time in the book, The Sin of Certainty, on the Bible is actually sort of to talk about the diversity of thinking in the Bible.
Right.
And how it's not just one way handed down. It's you actually have differences of opinion within the Bible among the biblical writers about all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. The Bible has been used ideologically, but I think it's a very non-ideological book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's well said. The book's been out for a few weeks now. What kind of responses are you receiving?
I mean, honestly, very positive. I mean, there always will be criticisms. You know, when, mm-hmm. when you talk about God and or the Bible and or Christianity, somebody's not going to like what you say.
Sure.
And that's just the way it is, and that's fine. But, you know, leaving that factor to the side, it's been refreshing to me and encouraging to me, the responses that I'm getting, because people are thinking this way, and some don't have the permission to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking for the permission to say, listen, I'm okay the way I am. I'm taking my life of faith very seriously. I'm not neglecting it, but this is how I'm feeling right now. And mm-hmm. it's good to know that I'm in good company, not just people writing books today, but even with figures in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, now that it's out, now that you're having discussions about it with people, what do you think you've learned along the way?
I want to say nothing, but that's not true. You know, one thing I've learned is that on one level, it's soothing, and I would even say therapeutic, to, let's say, admit that I'm not certain about things. So there's a relief to that that's very, very positive. But sooner or later, what comes after that is another thing, which is, okay, well, there's a price to pay, in a sense. And I mean that not as negative as it sounds, but, okay, what do you believe?
Mm-hmm.
And why? You know, if you're saying it's okay not to be certain, what do you feel certain about, mm-hmm. if anything? In other words, there's admitting the presence of uncertainty in your life, this moment of just putting the brakes on and saying, okay, I realize that old way is not helpful to me. But then the constructive part begins, which, okay, now what does it look like to live a life of faith?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good question, isn't it, right? Mm-hmm. That's what mm-hmm. this is about, is we're always asking ourselves, how am I faithful now and here? And that's where, you know, these periods of uncertainty, I think, bring us to ask that kind of question with greater clarity. But answering that constructive question is not easy. It's right. actually easier to say, that old way is wrong. I don't agree with that. I can't live there anymore. The constructive question takes a lot more energy, I think, actually.
Mm-hmm. Most of the people I know who are really devoted to certainty in the realm of religion claim to be very religious people. How do you reconcile that kind of dogmatism with the Christian virtue of humility?
Well, it's hard to, you know. See, the thing is, you know, again, there are biblical models for being very assertive and confident. You know, you have Paul, for example, quite often being confident and assertive, and we sort of equate that with the nature of the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, Paul also talks an awful lot about humility and love, mm-hmm. as much as anybody in
right.
the Bible.
Right.
And it is hard to sort of reconcile those two things, because we want to have a confident faith, if we can, but we also want to sort of give each other a break and realize that, you know, person over here may feel confident and certain about some things, but the way to show true love and humility toward the other is to respect where they are on their journey and not say, there's something wrong with you because you're not like me.
Yeah.
I think that works the other side, too, because I know sometimes I hear people talk about feeling uncertain and really struggling with doubt mm-hmm. as almost a point of pride.
Right.
Like, I've gotten right. over all that certainty stuff. Look at me. I just don't believe in anything anymore. I'm really yeah. sure. Isn't that cool? Well, and then you look down on people who aren't at that place where you are.
Yeah.
And there's lack of humility going both ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do we coexist as people in fellowship under one God when we're just at different stages, let's say, in different mm-hmm. places in our spiritual journeys? I think that's an age-old problem in the church.
Right. Is there one thing you could say you would like every reader of this book to take away with them once they've read it?
That when you're struggling with uncertainty, you're not broken. Accept that as a normal part of faith.
Peter Enns is a biblical scholar, theologian, and writer. He's written widely on the relationship between science and religion, Christianity and evolution, and Old Testament interpretation. Earlier this month, Harper One published his latest book, The Sin of Certainty, Why God Desires Our Trust More Than Our Correct Beliefs. Dr. Enns is the Abraham S. Clemens Professor of Biblical Studies at Eastern University. And Pete, I just have to tell you how much the book means to me and how much I thank you for sharing it and also for being willing to come on State of Belief Radio and share that knowledge with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Walton. I appreciate it.
As the slate of Republican presidential hopefuls for the White House quickly melted away this cycle, it was noteworthy that the candidates most appealing to the much-vaunted evangelical base didn't seem to get much traction. Ted Cruz made a valiant play for this constituency, it's true. But the most obvious representatives like Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum never had a chance this time around. So, what does that mean? Does that mean the evangelical vote is a thing of the past? Offering some thoughtful analysis on that question is journalist Sarah Posner. Recently, she's been writing about this subject in the New York Times and Rolling Stone magazine. And I'm happy, as always, to have Sarah back on State of Belief Radio. Sarah, good to have you again.
It's good to be back, Welton.
So, what does this election season suggest about the power of the evangelical voting bloc?
I think it suggests, first off, that at least for this cycle, Donald Trump has reordered the way one wins the Republican presidential nomination. Typically, we've seen candidates like Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Ted Cruz, who really cater to the Christian nation enthusiasts, people who believe that the founding fathers intended us to have a theocracy, people who are adamantly still opposed to same-sex marriage, opposed to abortion. And it's true that in the last two election cycles, that preferred candidate didn't win the nomination. John McCain wasn't that candidate, and Mitt Romney certainly wasn't that candidate. But you saw both of them eventually come around to catering to that constituency, either by word or by deed. In McCain's case, it was by deed, picking Sarah Palin. And in Mitt Romney's case, really, really just sucking up his past support for same-sex marriage and abortion rights and really pandering to this constituency. Donald Trump did none of those things and doesn't show very many signs right now, even with his meetings with Paul Ryan and Rentz Priebus and other prominent Republicans. He's not showing any signs of doing any of those things, with the possible exception of picking a Christian right candidate for his running mate. Mm-hmm. So I think that it has shown the Republican Party that voters perhaps are not necessarily interested in that kind of pandering. Maybe it shows that this constituency doesn't have the same clout that it once did within the Republican Party. I think that's premature to draw that conclusion. Mm-hmm. But I think that Trump brought a number of factors to the table here and was benefited by some unique problems that his opponents had, and was able to win the Republican nomination without doing those things, and probably without doing those things going forward.
Yeah. I know there's a range of different analyses about all of this. I'm particularly interested in hearing you expand on what led you to your conclusions about what's obviously happening and what may be happening as a result of this.
Well, there's no question that the religious right is experiencing a power vacuum at the moment. I think back in the 80s, 90s, and even in the early 2000s, there were a few people who were thought to speak for the movement. Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, James Dobson, you know, there were a handful of guys who were the people that the media went to to speak on behalf of American evangelicals and the religious right broadly. And they did, you know, in terms of their control over big organizations with lots of money, you know, they were, I think, you know, in some ways entitled to that kind of stature. As those figures passed away or retired in Dobson's case, and as a new generation of evangelicals started to emerge, you started to see some splits arising. Mm-hmm. And some of these splits had to do with style. There were people who were embarrassed by and tired of the Bible thumping, perpetually demonizing enemies, perpetually talking about how America was founded by a Christian nation and passing off these lies about what the founding fathers intended on that front. And then what you also saw was evangelicals who started speaking out against the Republican Party's position on immigration. They were trying to advocate for immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump capitalized on those changes and tensions that were taking place within the religious right. He took advantage of the fact that there was this power vacuum and that there wasn't somebody or a couple of somebodies who spoke on behalf of the movement. And he knew that by the force of his personality, which, as I've written, is more like a televangelist than mm-hmm. an evangelical, mm-hmm. that he would be able to reach voters who didn't necessarily feel represented by some of the people who were getting a lot of press. People like Russell Moore, the president of the political arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, who is pro-immigration reform and has tussled with Trump on Twitter about these things. So Trump capitalized on that, and he gambled on his hunch, I suspect, which he turned out to be right about, that many evangelicals in the pews, and including many Southern Baptists in the pews, did not agree with elite evangelical opinion about immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And so that Trump was reaching those voters much better than a Russell Moore was. He also benefited from his three major rivals being imperfect candidates for the religious right. So mm-hmm. we'll say Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz. I think Jeb Bush was seen by some evangelicals as a solid candidate, but not a particularly inspiring one.
Mm-hmm.
I think Marco Rubio represented that wing that wanted kind of that softer style, the less demonizing style, the possibly pro-immigration reform style, but even he backed down on his previous positions for immigration reform. And I think that Ted Cruz, while on paper a perfect candidate for the religious right, suffered from the fact that it was a poorly kept secret that he isn't well-liked by his colleagues. And he isn't really very well-liked among evangelicals either. He's got mm-hmm. an abrasive personality, and he overplays a lot of these supposed evangelical issues in a way that even makes some evangelicals uncomfortable. So he did manage to get more of the evangelical vote than any of the other presidential aspirants mm-hmm. did. I mean, he and Trump were basically splitting the evangelical vote between them. But I think that it's that kind of constellation of different factors that led to Trump emerging as the favorite among Republicans and in many states among evangelicals.
You wrote one thing that I just found very interesting. You wrote about the history of evangelicals forgiving chosen candidates their sins. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's a double entendre, which it could be, or exactly what you meant about that.
Well, that was just to point out that, obviously, on a personal level, Trump is an imperfect evangelical candidate.
Mm-hmm.
He's married 3 times. He's bragged about his sex life. He's extremely crude about sex and women. So these are things that, you know, I think for a lot of evangelicals cannot get past that. I mean, they mm-hmm. simply cannot get past that and will not vote for him for that and other reasons. And I was pointing out that when it comes to Republican candidates, evangelicals are not necessarily expecting perfection, mm-hmm. but they are expecting forgiveness and redemption, right?
That's right.
You have a candidate like Ronald Reagan, he also had been married before, mm-hmm. or George W. Bush, who had drinking issues, but both of them spoke that evangelical language. Reagan talked about the shining city on the hill and had this like very optimistic, sort of gauzy civil religion kind of view of America. And Bush very much spoke the evangelical language and did talk about redemption and being saved. And so those are things that make evangelicals more comfortable with somebody who might have what they consider to be sin in their past. But Trump has explicitly said he's never asked God for forgiveness, and he shows no evidence of having been saved or experience, you know, a new birth or a new life in Jesus Christ, which is something that evangelicals look for in a candidate typically.
Is that about religion, or is it about being tired of losing elections?
Well, right. I mean, obviously there is that. And I think a lot of it, quite frankly, is driven by antipathy to President Obama and racist attitudes over having had a black president for 7 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that when you look at a lot of the rhetoric that is being flung around about Obama and what he's done to our country and how terrible it is, I think that plays a big role. But I will also add that I think that that is not uncommon for non-Trump voters, too. Mm-hmm. I covered the South Carolina primary, and I talked to voters at Rubio and Cruz rallies also, and you definitely got the sense that their world had been upended, or their vision of what America is had been upended during the Obama presidency. And I think that a lot of Republican voters are looking for a candidate that they think can restore America to what it was before Obama did terrible things like give everyone health insurance. Yeah. And it's that, and it's just the contraception mandate and his position on same-sex marriage. It's a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
But I actually had a white voter in Columbia, South Carolina, say to me, I really wish things could just go back to the way they used to be. And I said, what do you mean, when? He said, well, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And to me, like the lack of awareness of a white person who lives in South Carolina, the seat of the Confederacy, saying that he wanted things to be like they were in the 50s and 60s was just sort of, yeah, I was a little bowled over by that, to be honest.
I can see why. Well, how is Trump going to deal with the evangelicals going forward now? Do you see any outreach on the part of the Trump campaign to evangelicals, or is he just going to do what Trump does and they can like it or not?
I think probably the latter, although he obviously does have evangelicals who are in his camp, and I think he's going to advertise that as much as possible. And also, you're seeing increasing numbers of evangelicals with positions of some prominence who are getting behind Trump. And I think you're going to see that more and more as time goes on. And there are going to be the holdouts for sure, the Russell Moores, some others. But I think that for some arch conservative evangelicals, for some evangelicals who cannot stomach the idea of a Hillary Clinton presidency, they're going to eventually come around to Trump. I mean, I think that you can't discount antipathy towards Hillary Clinton as playing a role in driving evangelical voters to Trump.
I've heard a lot of people say, you know, this is just the end of the religious right. And I think back through the years, I've heard that funeral announcement hundreds of times.
Oh, yes.
without a corpse.
Yeah. I don't think it's the end of the religious right.
Yeah.
I think that what we're seeing is this unusual moment where a candidate like Trump was able to ascend to the Republican nomination. But I think that it's not going to stymie the conservative evangelical desire to ban abortion in this country, to continue to press for religious freedom exemptions, to continue to press for, you know, these laws that restrict transgender people from entering the bathroom that they want to enter. none of that is going to go away. And I think that at the end of the day, when an evangelical who's ardently against abortion is considering, do I stay home, do I vote for Hillary Clinton, or do I vote for Donald Trump, who's going to owe something to us, namely a Supreme Court justice who would vote to overturn Roe. And so I think that that dynamic, Trump at some point is going to realize, like, he may be unpredictable and he may do whatever he wants when it comes right down to it, but what's it to him? I mean, like, does he really care about abortion one way or the other? So I think in order to get something from the Republican base, I could see him nominating a Supreme Court justice that would satisfy them. Yeah. And that might be part of the art of the deal that he strikes with the Republican Party.
Sarah Posner is a prolific journalist covering religion and politics. We'll link to her New York Times and Rolling Stone articles on Trump and the evangelical vote. And I encourage you to follow Sarah Posner's work at sarahposner.com. Sarah is also the author of the book, God's Prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. As always, thank you for taking time to be with us and come again on to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Let them know we'd like for their voice to be a part of the conversation. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.